the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, yesterday on Lifetime Income, we discussed the problems of sequence risk, bear markets. We discussed the results of the Economic Institute survey on retirement. And one of the biggest risks for retirees is facing a bear market or recession at the beginning of their retirement. Joining me as my guest today is Wade Fow. He's professor of retirement income at American College. And professor, let's talk about sequence risk, because a lot of retirees don't think about this. For example, I've seen studies where when you retire towards the end of your retirement, you should have a larger concentration of equities that helps you get through your later retirement years. But at the beginning of your retirement years, you don't want to take a lot of risk, and a bear market could be very devastating. So let's talk about sequence risk. I wonder if you might describe the implications of it, what it is, and how that might impact severely someone's retirement.
Well, sequence risk really is one of the major risks in retirement. And it's the idea that even if somebody has, say, a long 30-year retirement, it doesn't really matter so much what the average return is over that 30-year period. It matters what order of returns are, because if poor market returns happen early on, that's going to derail a retirement, even if the market does great later. And conversely, if the market does very well early in retirement, that can sustain that retirement indefinitely. And it's all about the idea of taking distributions from the portfolio and having to suffer market losses, so that if I take a distribution from my portfolio, I begin retirement, and then my portfolio value drops, to maintain my same standard of living, I'm going to have to take an increasing percentage of what's left, and I'm depleting the portfolio more quickly with my distributions, so that even if the overall market recovers, my portfolio doesn't get to experience the full recovery. I've been selling these assets at a loss. I've been creating a hurdle where I need to earn a higher and higher rate of return on my portfolio just to keep it at this same lower level. And that's the practical implication of sequence risk, that it really amplifies market volatility. It really bases the outcomes in retirement on what happens in a narrow period, in the first, say, 5 or 10 years of a long retirement. That's really going to drive the kind of sustainable standard of living that retiree is going to have.
If we could just illustrate that for my listeners, let's just say, to make it easy, you had a $100,000 portfolio, you were taking out 4% a year, so you're taking out $4,000. And let's also assume that you own 10,000 shares of various mutual funds at $10 a share. We go through a bear market, as we did between 2000, 2002, and 2007 and 2009. Let's say that $10 share value drops to somewhere around $6 or $7 a share. As you're liquidating those shares, you're liquidating shares at 10, at 9, 8, 7, or maybe $6 a share. And so you're getting rid of a lot more of your share count. What does an investor do? Because you have a lot of people that are nearing retirement, or maybe just starting out in retirement, and most financial plans come up with a portfolio mix of, you know, so much in bond funds, so much in stock funds. But we know, even as we've seen in 2013, and we know the Fed's raising interest rates, people could lose money in bond funds as well.
Right. And so just to be clear, sequence risk does exist prior to retirement as well, if you're adding new savings every year. But it gets worse post-retirement when you transition from saving to taking distributions. And so it really is important in retirement to plan for this. There's four general strategies for how to deal with sequence of returns risk. To mention the four, it's to spend conservatively to reduce the distribution rate that you need to meet your goals, to spend flexibly so that if there is a market downturn, if you're willing to cut your spending, that can go a long way towards helping to manage sequence risk. To reduce the portfolio's volatility at key moments in retirement so that you're not exposed to the possibility of these big market losses and having to sell assets at a significant loss. And then also the fourth method is to have some sort of buffer asset, something outside of the investment portfolio that doesn't really move up and down in the same direction as the portfolio, that you may be able to draw from during years where the markets are down and you'd otherwise have to sell assets at a loss. So that's the four main categories for how to deal with sequence of returns risk.
Yeah, and the one thing I want to point out is bear markets can sometimes be quite long and extensive. I mean, if we take a look at the S&P 500, it peaked in March of 2000, went down for 2 years, then went back up for 5 years, and then went down again for 2 years. So it wasn't until April of 2013 that the S&P passed its previous high. So basically, if you were in an index fund, you went nowhere for almost a 13-year period. And the other thing, Professor, let's talk about anytime you get stock markets overvalued, like, for example, today on a valuation basis, we're dealing with the second most expensive stock market in history. But also more importantly, if I take a look at things that normally retirees would invest in, safe kind of returns, a 2-year treasury note, for example, you used to get 6.5% and 5.5%. Today, with interest rates going up, it's only 1.4%, and 10-year treasuries are below 2.25%. So let's talk about the implications also of lower interest.
Both of these factors, to the extent that low interest rates, it's kind of a mathematical reality that the bond returns are going to be lower in the future. The stock market, it's more controversial, but definitely, right, all these valuation measures suggest that we should be thinking about lower stock market returns in the future. Lower stock returns, lower bond returns both translate into lower sustainable withdrawal rates. And just the reality about the historical record, for much of the historical record, the income and dividends being generated by a portfolio would have exceeded something like the 4% rule, the idea that you could spend 4% of your assets. Today, with dividends lower, with interest rates lower, and with the income being generated by a portfolio being less, it's necessary to sell principal to meet the 4% rule style goals for retirement income. And that further amplifies sequence of returns risk, because that's making it more easy that you get into that position of having to sell shares at a loss. So portfolios today are not generating the type of income that would sustain something like the 4% rule without having to sell principal as well. So yeah, it's a tough environment. There's more danger of sequence of returns risk when these income measures are less, just because it implies that need to sell principal.
You know, when does an individual start to begin to worry about sequence risk? Obviously, if you just retired at the beginning of your retirement, but let's say you are 5 or 10 years away from retirement, when does it become critical that you start thinking about sequence risk? Because, for example, let's say that in 2007, you decided that you're 5 years away from retirement. And then all of a sudden you go through the bear market of 2007 and 2009 and you retire in 2012. I mean, when does it become critical? 5 years before you retire? 10 years before you retire? What are the periods that you would recommend that people be concerned about sequence risk? Because obviously, if I'm 25 years old, I don't care about sequence risk because I've got 30, 40 years of my working career ahead of me.
Right. When you're 25 years old, actually the market returns at that point matter very little for your lifetime financial outcomes because most of your savings are still coming in the future. But yeah, I agree with the idea. Just 5 or 10 years before retirement, that's really a key point where you start making that transition from preparing for distribution, preparing to spend down assets in retirement, and whether that involves some sort of annuitization to prepay for retirement, or another avenue for those who don't like annuities is just using individual bonds to start transitioning to, with those savings in that last 5 to 10 years of retirement, build out an income bond ladder that when you then reach the retirement date, you'll have a series of bonds that will mature over the next 5 or 10 years, providing income for those years and therefore helping to relieve stress on the idea that if the markets are down at that point, you won't have to sell your investment portfolio at losses. You'll have these bonds that are maturing at that point and providing the income for those years. And yeah, 5 or 10 years before retirement, if you start setting that up, that can really help to manage a sequence of returns risk. And that will probably bring the stock allocation down during those last years without having to sell stocks to rebalance into bonds, but to just put all the new savings into bonds can be a way to go glide into retirement with a lower stock allocation and less exposure to volatility.
You know, I've been in this business 37 years, and during that period of time, I've seen bear markets of all kinds. And Professor, I found most bear markets last between 18 months, maybe 2 years at the longest. So what about the concept that, let's say, if you're retired, of keeping, let's say, 2 years worth of living expense in liquid cash, so that, for example, if the stock market is dropping, as it did between 2007 and 9 or 2000 and 2002, you could live off kind of like a savings account versus spending down or selling your shares and spending down your assets. What about keeping what I would call a large cash reserve that you can draw on during a bear market?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the possibilities that would fall under that. When I mentioned those four categories, that would be the buffer asset, that you have this other asset that's not correlated with the rest of the investment portfolio, so that if your portfolio is crashing, the cash should be a relatively stable, a low return, but a relatively stable return. And then you could have that opportunity. You'd have 2 years, as you mentioned, of spending covered by your cash that sits outside of the investment portfolio. That's an option. It does, of course, you have the drag that in a normal market environment, you're not going to be getting the same types of returns, but you're really thinking of that as a risk management technique. And that's definitely a viable option for that sort of buffer asset that's not going to be going down in value when the rest of the portfolio is going down in value.
And let's talk about some of these other strategies. So one strategy is to have a large enough buffer asset, whether it's cash or CDs or maybe even short-term bonds that come due, that you can spend without drawing down your assets. Let's talk about some of the other strategies of the four you mentioned. Let's talk about a flexible budget.
Yeah, so spending flexibly is helpful. At the extreme, if you just take a percentage of whatever is left in your portfolio each year, then there's actually not any sequence of returns risk, because it doesn't at that point matter what order the returns come. You can test it out. You still end up with the same amount of wealth at the end. You're relieving stress on the portfolio, that if the markets are down and your portfolio is down in value, you're going to spend less at that point. So you're selling less shares and you're not digging that hole for yourself. It can be a difficult strategy to work with just because it makes your spending more unpredictable, especially if you have an investment portfolio that tends to go up and down. You have to be ready to cut your spending when the portfolio goes down. But that's difficult for some people, to the extent that a retiree has more fixed expenses that are not flexible. It's harder to take that approach. But for others who may have, you know, their Social Security benefit, they may have a defined benefit pension, they may have a lot of income from outside the investment portfolio that can help to protect their lifestyle, and they may then have the capacity to be more flexible with their spending and to use that approach as a way to manage sequence of returns risk.
And what about the idea that, you know, in retirement planning, let's say you put together a budget, you've got a fixed portion, and then you have, let's say, a discretionary portion that might be hobbies, it might be trips that you take. It seems to me that if you break up your budget into two parts, that discretionary portion, which could include travel, eating out at restaurants, that is one that is easy to adjust. For example, if you're planning on spending, you know, you take a trip to Europe or one major trip, well, maybe you stay domestically and you don't go to Europe during the year that you're having a bear market, or you don't eat out at restaurants as much.
Right. So that would be the best part of the budget too, if you have flexibility there and it doesn't really hurt your standard of living too much to make those sort of adjustments and have those other options available, then right, that would be the part of the budget where you could apply that sort of flexible spending rule. And that can help you spend more initially because you're willing to make the cuts if necessary later on. And you may have a better overall standard of living throughout your lifetime, especially if you aren't impacted by the sequence of returns risk. It's a way to potentially spend more throughout retirement. But it is necessary when thinking along the route to cut spending if necessary, to have a rule in place that you're going to follow and adhere to. Otherwise, you are creating risk if you spend too much and aren't willing to make the cuts later on if they're necessary.
Let's talk about the final two strategies for mitigating this sequence risk. The first we talked about was having buffer assets. The second is having a flexible budget that you can adjust downward if need be, if you go through a bear market. Let's talk about the final two.
Well, the next one is to just spend conservatively. The lower your spending rate, the less exposed you are to sequence of returns risk, because then you're not getting into that negative feedback cycle of having to sell a bigger and bigger percentage of what's left if the market is going down. So that's the whole concept of the 4% rule. The 4% rule for retirement was meant to be a conservative spending rate. It was linked to the worst cases that happened over different historical periods in the U.S. I question whether it's as pessimistic as it seems, because we don't have a lot of experience with this type of low interest rate environment at the starts of retirement. But nonetheless, whatever that number is, whether it's 4% or 3% or even less, that's the whole concept of spending conservatively, but then at least trying to adhere to that spending level so that you're not really going to be flexible with spending. You just start at a lower number and stick with it. So that's the third one. And the fourth one is to try to manage volatility, or to not be as exposed to volatility at key points in your life cycle. So the spending conservatively strategy that I mentioned, all the research about that usually calls for retirees to have a pretty aggressive investment portfolio of, say, 50 to 75% stocks. And that's sometimes too high for people. They're not comfortable with that. So the other alternative, well, to think about different ways to reduce portfolio volatility when it matters the most. So that could either be have a lower stock allocation in the early part of retirement, thinking about using individual bonds or income annuities, different types of lifetime income flows that are not exposed to market volatility, or to think what we were discussing earlier about, like with the market valuation levels and so forth, that when the stock market is valued highly relative to its past, you may want to, if you've otherwise can meet your lifestyle in retirement, lower your stock allocation a little bit at that time before any sort of downturn, and to be less exposed to the potential for a downturn when the stock market is valued more highly than usual.
One of the things that we've shied away from is, given this high valuation market and low interest rates, we're using what we call the 3% rule, because, you know, when you're talking about 4% and you have 10-year treasuries that are lower than 2.25%, you know, it's kind of hard to get that kind of rate of return unless you're in the stock market. And then when you look at the stock market, you're overpaying for stocks today. I want to ask you, when you said manage volatility, you talk about lowering the stock portfolio, individual bonds, or income annuities. Professor, when it comes to annuities, why have annuities gotten such a bad rap? Because at one time, when defined benefit pension plans were the norm in this country, if you worked in the private sector, essentially what you had was an income annuity. The company put aside so much money for your retirement, and when you retired, they had a lump. They went to an insurance company. They said, based on your age or that of your spouse, this is what we're going to give you as a monthly check for the rest of your life. Why do you think annuities have gotten such a bad name?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons for it, but one of the basic ones, there's a lot of different types of annuities that are very complex, and the simple income annuity only represents about 4% of annuity sales. It's not really discussed all that frequently by a lot of different parties because they have no incentive for an insurance agent. Simple income annuities have very low commissions, so it's not worth the effort to try to sell them, and then investment-based financial advisors tend to also think that they're not a good idea. They can take away from the asset base that the investment manager is able to manage. But I think it's a pity that income annuities don't get more respect, because the power of pooling risk, of bringing together a large group of people, just like a pension, a traditional defined benefit pension did, that is a really powerful source of returns that an investment portfolio can't provide. I think just too much of the conventional wisdom about how to treat wealth management is to create these examples where, well, you're going to get an 8% fixed return every year, and they show your wealth accumulation and show how much you can spend with a fixed 8% return every year. And of course, if you could get that kind of number, well, then you may not need an annuity. But the reality is retirees cannot rely on getting a fixed 8% return every year of retirement. They're not going to be at 100% stocks. And even then, that number is pretty high. And sequence of returns risk, if you get a negative return early on, that can really derail everything. But I just think too much of conventional wisdom just kind of thinks of the stock market as a fixed return and doesn't think about the impact of volatility, therefore doesn't think about the impact of sequence of returns risk, and then doesn't really look at the value or merit of an income annuity. They just think the income annuity is you're giving up all your upside, when that's not the case at all. With partial annuitization, that can give you the ability to invest more aggressively with what's left. And if you live past your life expectancy, you're probably going to leave a larger legacy with partial annuitization, which may seem counterintuitive because the annuity itself doesn't provide any legacy. What you're able to do with that and what you're able to do with the rest of the portfolio and with the ability to cover your income needs partially through the risk pooling, the subsidies from those who did not live as long paid to those who live longer, it's really powerful for somebody who can enjoy a long retirement.
Yeah, it's amazing because professors like yourself, a Nobel Prize winner, Robert Merton at Harvard, have talked about the impact of income annuities as being a great retirement vehicle. But as you mentioned, income annuities are a low commission annuity, so insurance agents or advisors don't have incentive to sell them versus regular annuities or other products. Then you also have the money management industry that says, hey, let's say a guy has $200,000 in a portfolio, $100,000 is put into an annuity, that advisor would not get any fees off the annuity for the rest of the annuity's life, which will be the person's life. But the more important thing is you talk about pooling of risk. The nice thing about the income annuity is you can't outlast it as you could your assets. In other words, as long as you live, the insurance company guarantees you that income for your life or that of your spouse.
Yeah, that's a very important point that for investment managers, they tend to be very anti-annuity. There's even the commercials about, you know, I hate annuities and so should you. But that's because they lose assets to manage. And if they're charging a percentage of the asset base that they manage, they're giving up their revenues by recommending that one of their clients use an income annuity. So, right, it's an unfortunate situation that we're moving away from the defined benefit pensions in the United States, but there's not enough effort to replace that, and it's putting too much pressure and stress on individual households to manage all these risks with an investment portfolio when it's really not efficient to do that. Risk pooling is a much more efficient way to manage longevity risk and the sequence of returns risk in retirement.
Now, you've written a number of articles. I know you've written on using annuities as part of a portfolio, income portfolio, and you've also written about sequence risk. Professor, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the research that you've done on producing retirement income, tell them how they could do so, please.
Oh, sure. Thank you. So my personal webpage is retirementresearcher.com. It's all one word, retirement researcher, ER at the end, researcher.com. And that, yeah, everything I write will show up there at some point. So thank you.
Well, listen, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. All the best, and come back and talk to us again.
Okay, my pleasure.
You know, one of the points that we've been emphasizing on this program, and as we did on yesterday's program, is sequence risk. Because we do know this, this bull market is 8 years old. The economic recovery is 8 years old. And we know that central banks and governments haven't repealed business cycles or bear markets. And so, as you know, that as stock prices get more and more expensive, you really need to look at reducing sequence risk, whether you're 5 or 10 years away from retirement or you just retired. There are a number of research that has been done. Robert Merton at Harvard University has written about this. And of course, Professor Pfau, who we just had on the program. So I hope you'll do some research on this because it could really make a difference if you're nearing retirement or you just retired. You do not want to go through a bear market. As we pointed out earlier, it took 2 years from the peak of the bull market in March of 2000. It bottomed in the summer of 2002. The market went up for the next 5 years, but then in 2007, the market peaked again. And for the next 2 years, stock prices dropped. And it wasn't until April of 2013 that the S&P finally exceeded its old highs. You do not want to go through that again. Well, as usual, we've run out of time. We hope you enjoyed today's program. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.